This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to another season of Radio EcoShock, where the strange new climate is already happening.
When the power goes off, you can expect it to be off 3 to 7 days.
This week on Radio EcoShock, we have two reports on the major weather event that could reshape America and the world economy, the unbelievable Hurricane Harvey. But that's not all. At the same time, even worse floods have killed thousands in Africa, India, and East Asia. That's part of global wetting, as the warmer oceans feed more water vapor into the heated atmosphere. On the other side of the jet stream, fires continue in the western states and around my home in Canada. That's after a disastrous fire season in Portugal, Spain, and Italy, more fires in Siberia, and even on Greenland. I'm going to squeeze in some of the jaw-dropping headlines you may have missed this summer. I'm Alex Smith. When a major weather event strikes, Bob Henson is deluged with media calls. During the summer, when we agreed to talk, we had no idea a monster storm for the history books would strike Houston, all of East Texas, and Louisiana. It is far from over as we speak, but let's get an update from the author of one of the most widely used college textbooks on weather. Bob Henson worked at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. He's the author of The Thinking Person's Guide to Climate Change. I read Bob's reports often at Wonderground, the weather underground hub. Bob Henson, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you, Alex. It's great to be back.
Well, you know, we have a fire emergency right now here in British Columbia. There's smoke out there in the air, but it's nothing like the tragedy unfolding in Houston, Texas. Bob, talk to us about some of the records this strange event called Harvey has set.
Well, the records are still tumbling pretty much as we speak, but there's some records that we already know are completely gone, and quite a few, actually. I mean, I think the headline in terms of records is that this is by far the most rain that's ever fallen on a major U.S. city over the course of a few days. I mean, not just by a little bit, but by a lot. Basically, the Harris County is pretty much synonymous with Houston. You know, the city limits, I believe, are almost the same as the Harris County, if not identical. And the heaviest rain pretty much encompassed the entire county. So that was one of the dimensions of the tragedy. But in that area, in Harris County, and in actually a broader area that is, you know, almost the size of, say, Rhode Island, rainfall totals were above 30 inches, in some cases above 40 inches, which is a phenomenal amount. For those of you in the metric system, more than a meter, you know, to have that much fall in a few days, even for a wet area like Houston, is really really devastating. When you translate that into recurrence intervals, which is what are often known as return periods, or say a 1-in-100-year event or a 1-in-1,000, the amount of rain we're talking about over Harris County is, you know, roughly a return interval of 500 to 1,000 years. It doesn't mean it would recur that often like clockwork, but on average over many, many thousands of years, you would expect something like this to happen about every 500 to 1,000 years. So an enormous, enormous amount of rain. We knew this area could rain heavily. It's just not usually over this broad an area and not usually centered right on Houston. So those were some of the really intense aspects of this storm. It did set the record already for the highest amount of rain to fall from a tropical cyclone in the U.S. The old record was 48 inches, set in 1978, also in Texas. And at last check, the most highest official total from a reliable observer was 49.32 inches.
Wow. Well, you know, I have seen archival footage showing that Houston has flooded before, as you know, back from 1935 on. Does this big storm compare to that previous flooding, or is this something else again?
I would say this is something else again. I mean, certainly Houston has had big rains, and a lot of the flooding, for example, the events in 1929 and 1935, a lot of that flooding occurred because the city hadn't really figured out how to deal with its waterways. So you had waterways like Buffalo Bayou that head from West Houston into downtown, and so those would just become rampaging rivers in a heavy rainstorm. It wouldn't necessarily have to be a gigantic one, just a flash flood type setup. And as a result, the city decided to develop two big reservoirs that sit west of downtown about 15 miles, and those are called Attucks and Barker. And that's been a pretty interesting story the last day or two in itself, because those reservoirs were designed to hold basically a 1,000-year flood event, which is somewhat different from a 1,000-year rain. You can have a 1,000-year rain, but it may not necessarily cause a 1,000-year flood. The flooding depends on the landscape and, you know, not only how much rain is falling, but how much has fallen in the last few weeks, say, and whether it's falling on pavement or absorbent ground. In any event, those reservoirs were designed to handle a 1,000-year rainfall, and they began overtopping. Attucks Reservoir, the water began to flow around the spillway for the first time since these dams were built in the 1940s. So we're still going to have to see how high the water goes and how high it stays high, because these dams are not in the best of shape, and there's no sign of imminent collapse or anything, but this is certainly going to make keeping those dams together a bit more challenging.
You know, Bob, I don't fully understand why Harvey would stall over Houston and East Texas like that. Why didn't it move on like other storms do?
That's a very good question. And in fact, you know, this is one of those quirks of weather. Sometimes the currents that steer tropical cyclones, the upper-level winds that we think of as the jet stream, but in fact they permeate the whole atmosphere a few miles high, sometimes there's just little areas we call call areas, which means the winds are have just collapsed. There's just no wind there. The flow is all going in other directions, and that's exactly what happened to Harvey. It moved up just west of Houston, and then there was simply no air to cart it away, and it sat there. This is not super common or frequent, but there are really vivid examples. I mean, for example, 1963, Hurricane Flora might be one of the closest analogs. That's a hurricane that moved up toward Cuba and then basically stalled and did a small loop, just like Harvey is doing, and then moved on off. But it actually dumped on the order of 100 inches of rain on Santiago de Cuba.
That's a crazy amount of rain. You might as well just go underwater for a while, like the ocean or something.
Yeah, if you live in a dry climate, it's kind of hard to fathom or picture that much rain in a short time.
I can't imagine it. And of course, you know, making it worse, as you kind of mentioned, is Houston is such a big sprawling city, and there's so much concrete and so much pavement and buildings that there's nowhere for the water to go now that would have formerly just gone into the ground or found ways into the Gulf.
You're absolutely right, Alex. I actually went to college in Houston at Rice University, so I spent 5 years there. I vividly remember seeing fellow students taking kayaks to the streets of campus one time during heavy rain. And I was actually in Houston in 1979 when the United States 24-hour rainfall record was set, and that was 42 inches in one day. And this storm has not yet topped that record, to my knowledge. It's gotten close, but that one may be really difficult to pull down from its pedestal. But many, many other rainfall records were set. So it wasn't so much that one spot got, you know, a record amount in one day, but that a large area got a record amount over several days. And obviously that puts huge stress on hydrologic systems.
Well, now, the sheer magnitude of that endless rain reminds us of a hotter, wetter atmosphere. Do you think climate change is a contributing factor to what happened with Harvey?
Oh, absolutely. It's in the mix. The way I've been thinking of it is hurricanes are natural phenomena. They're happening in an atmosphere that is not natural. It's not the same atmosphere that we had 50 or 100 years ago. You know, quite literally, the carbon dioxide, which obviously the leading greenhouse gas added to the air by humans, that's up basically 30% since the industrial age, and more than 10 or 20% since the 50s. So these are natural events. You know, hurricanes have been around as long as we know, but they're happening in this climate context that is different. So it's almost as if you have different ingredients in the kitchen, or you're stocking more and more of certain kinds of ingredients, and the chef just waltzes in, who normally makes meals, but there's just a little more spice in one meal or something because there's just more spice available. I mean, it's kind of a crude analogy, but the idea is that the ingredients that go into all weather systems, you know, we've always had systems that have stalled, we've always had heavy rainers. Climate change is associated with a lot of the factors that made Harvey worse. We know in many parts of the world that the heaviest rainstorms are becoming heavier. This is a really well-established finding very consistent with what we would expect with science theory, that you've just got more moisture in the atmosphere in a warmer climate. There's more evaporating from the oceans, and that gets concentrated and squeezed out when you have a big rainmaker like Harvey was. And in addition, storm surge is higher, and that's a very definitive link to climate change. You know, oceans are higher, so when you get a hurricane, you've got a little bit higher storm surge. Now, that wasn't a particular issue with Harvey. There wasn't really that much storm surge damage, but certainly the rainfall and the storm's ability to intensify rapidly. Hurricanes need warm water, and the waters in that part of the Gulf are on the order of about a half degree Celsius warm, or about a degree Fahrenheit, as a result of climate change. Now, they were also about a degree Celsius above average for this time of year, but that can happen any time. That could have happened 100 years ago. So I think the more relevant index is what is the long-term warming in that part of the world. And you know, every time you boost the ocean temperatures by degree, you add a few percent to the amount of moisture that can be in the air. So I think that's a very relevant link. I think all these things say that, you know, Harvey is worse because of climate change. It's a very hard thing to prove, just as it's hard to prove that a certain cigarette gave you lung cancer. It's really something you diagnose over long periods of time, looking at many storms or many cigarettes. But certainly, the distinctive aspects of Harvey relate pretty closely to climate change, both observed climate change and expected climate change.
Yeah, I've been doing this for a few years, and I've never seen so many reports of extreme rainfall events all over the world. So it's just like a new phenomenon that keeps blurting out over the weather. You know, when it comes to Houston, there were multiple reports warning this kind of flooding could hit the city, and the city says it was prepared, but not for that kind of rainfall. Bob, I'm wondering, do you think Houston can adapt to this, or is it going to have to give up some ground, maybe permanently?
Houston is a challenge when it comes to floods, although a lot of cities are. But I think the Houston psychology, kind of the way Houston sees itself, having lived there a while, I think that makes it a challenge because Houston is kind of famously a very laissez-faire place. You know, there's very, very little zoning. You can, in some senses, almost have a church next to a strip mall, and nobody seems to care much. The city prides itself on being able to do things its own way and to have as light a government hand as possible. And that leads to a really dynamic economy at times. But, of course, the downside is that the less planning you have, the more vulnerable you are to events like this. One thing that really amazed me that I discovered just the last few days is that these two reservoirs in western Houston, Attucks and Barkers, those are what are called dry reservoirs. They were built in the 40s, not to hold water for the city to use, but simply to be retaining basins when you get a heavy rain. So normally they're dry, they're covered with grass and trees, but they're also partially covered with houses. There's private land abutting the reservoir on the other side of the dams, and there are houses there in the 500-year floodplain, is my understanding. And sure enough, with Harvey, just in the last couple of days, those houses have flooded. And there are probably a few cities in the country that would have a setup like that where houses are adjoining a reservoir literally on the back side of it with the knowledge that they could flood, and in fact now they have. So the civic philosophy of Houston makes it tough for it to adapt. Certainly the amount of growth they've had, the gigantic amount of pavement. In fact, the watershed behind Attucks, when it was built in the 40s, was essentially entirely rural. It's almost 50% now urban. And so you've got water pouring off concrete. You know, there's so much just existing infrastructure in Houston. I'm not sure how they're going to take the next steps after this, but I know there will be a lot of attention put to it. And, you know, hopefully some creative thinking and some ways to at least kind of come to terms with it.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're doing a bit of radio storm chasing during Hurricane Harvey. Our guest is the senior meteorologist, author, and blogger Bob Henson. Well, adding to your point, you know, when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, thousands of people fled to Houston, and some stayed there, so it's possible some folks are getting flooded out for the second time. When this is over, you've got, last I heard, 9,000 people in one convention center and more coming. There won't be enough homes for them all. Those homes will be damaged. They have to be rebuilt, replaced if they can be. There could be an exodus again, as there was from New Orleans, this time from Houston. What do you think?
Oh, I absolutely believe there will be to some extent. I mean, this is a civic tragedy, and I believe over the coming days we're going to see just how bad it is. It's one thing to get a quick flood in a house where the water comes up and then a few hours later it goes down, but I think in many of these cases, you're going to have water in homes for several days. And I think that makes it a lot harder to restore a house. And you've got thousands upon thousands of homes that have been flooded. It's going to be really tough. Even some of the homes flooded behind Barcarnatic's reservoir, because those reservoir waters have to drain down gradually, some of those houses are going to be underwater for a month. So there is going to be, I think, a housing crisis in Houston. I think there's going to be a lot of the same angst and stress and anxiety that hit after Katrina in New Orleans. It's a bigger city and probably an economy that could bounce back a little bit better than New Orleans in some ways, but there's still going to be a lot of pain and suffering. I should note that I have already heard of firsthand stories I've seen on TV of folks who were drowned out in Katrina, went to Houston, and now have lost everything again. So very, very, very heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. And, you know, another part of this is we don't know how much the storm will cost or whether governments can even cope with the recovery or how long it'll take to restore that Houston region, if it can be. But if it takes a long time, it's possible that another big flood could happen even before Texans manage to get over Harvey. Are the odds increasing that extreme rainfall events will strike again along the Gulf of Mexico?
I believe so. There has been some good work done, for example, by Climate Central in the last couple of years, in particular following the what we call the no-name flood in southeast Louisiana, which was just last year, where a tropic-like system, it wasn't technically a tropical cyclone, but it was like a very weak depression-type storm, moved from the Florida panhandle very slowly westward across Louisiana and dumped 20, 30 inches of rain over a couple of days. And Baton Rouge and some other areas were really hit hard. It was the most expensive U.S. disaster of 2016, more than $10 billion in costs, and many people thought it out without insurance. So in response to that, Climate Central did some work and found that the likelihood of that kind of rainstorm along the central Gulf Coast has increased and will continue to increase. And it just seems to be what's happening. You know, it's a little hard to suss out how much of a particular flood experience is because of the way the land's been built and developed and how much is due to the rain. But certainly in Houston, the flood events have become worse. You know, the record flood in the Attucks Reservoir was the tax day flood of 2016, so just 2 years ago. And so in the whole last 70 years, the two worst floods have been in the last 2 years. And I think that's a pretty telling index.
Yes, indeed. And just in the news, the Indian megacity of Mumbai was also crippled by incredible rains and floods at the end of August. And we may get to the point where a disrupted climate challenges this whole model of very large urban areas, or maybe it's the other way around. Megacities are the focal points for disrupting the climate. Bob, what do you think?
Well, certainly megacities have a lot of people that affect the climate. You know, there can be efficiencies in cities. I mean, the carbon footprint of many New Yorkers, for example, is quite low because they live in a densely populated area. They don't use as many resources, maybe, as folks living in a sprawling acreage. Those folks fly a lot, though, which I fly more than I ought to for the sake of the climate, then you can have a very large footprint. So I don't know if urbanity itself makes climate change worse. Certainly, if cities are in the developing world or places where people can live more lavish lifestyles, then you may have more carbon emissions. That's why I think it's important to do some leapfrog technologies so people, for example, go right from maybe having no power to having renewable energy instead of having to have coal-driven power in between. But getting back to the point about the way cities are built and events like floods, yes, a lot of big cities are on waterways or coastlines because people like to live near the water. And the larger city is, the harder it is to get people out, the more flood-prone it can be because of all those impervious concrete surfaces. And I do think that basically water, or flood water, is going to be one of the more and more one of the big natural disasters of this century that we just have to deal with.
Well, you know, when these things happen, the media tends to flood in with a big spotlight, and then people get a bit bored with that news, and something else happens, and the floodlights move on. But what should we be watching for as the after effects of Hurricane Harvey unwind?
Well, this is going to be a big test. For example, President Trump has emphasized infrastructure both in his campaign and since he took office. So if there were a golden moment for infrastructure development, I would say Houston is a good one because there's going to have to be a lot of development of the dam system. There may need to be a lot of road reconstruction, perhaps drainage systems. So I think this is a real opportunity to be innovative and creative with infrastructure. Unfortunately, it's going to take money, and it doesn't grow on trees. Or some early estimates I've seen, really ballpark, back-of-the-envelope estimates are, if just, say, 10% of the homes in Houston are lost, that would be roughly $30, $40 billion in damage. And then when you tack on the thousands of lost cars and other damage, we're probably talking a Katrina-level hurricane, if not worse. So probably the costliest hurricane in U.S. history when it's all said and done. And one thing to watch in particular is many, many of these folks who have lost everything do not have flood insurance. In the United States, we do not have a private flood insurance model. For many folks, the only place to get it is through the government. And if you're not in a 100-year floodplain, you're generally not required to get flood insurance to have a mortgage. So being the humans that we are, we'll put off costs unless we think we're going to have to pay for them down the line. So many, many folks in Houston, I think only 1 in 6 homes are covered by the flood insurance program. Even that is going to throw a number on the program because the program is already $25 billion in debt. This could add tens of billions more. So the government is facing a twofold tab. It has to bolster the flood insurance program, which is actually right now set to expire at the end of September. So this is going to be a real high-profile event. And as well, there's going to probably be what they call a supplemental bill to pay for a recovery for Harvey, just as we had for Sandy and Katrina. And that could be on the order of tens of billions of dollars. And these dwarf some of the things like the ask for funding for a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. So there may be some interesting political battles ahead.
We'll be watching for that. We've been talking with Bob Henson, the veteran meteorologist, journalist, and storm chaser from Colorado. When it comes to major weather events, there's no one better, in my opinion. Find Bob Henson at wonderground.com and follow him on Twitter at bhensonweather. Bob, on behalf of our listeners, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Alex. Take good care.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Covering the world. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This summer, I took time out to walk the river trail, to grow some of my own food, get the firewood in, to love life and the earth. I should be happy, but instead, I'm angry. This great life is becoming the facade which hides much greater evil. More than ever, we are being played. Whether it's Vladimir Putin scheming to replace democracy with right-leaning autocrats around the world, or the Koch brothers spending millions to feed our doubts about climate change, it's all heading in the same ugly direction. Yes, I've been entertained by the greatest geopolitical drama of this century. I checked the Twitter feeds of Claude Taylor at True Facts Stated and Louise Mensch to get the inside track on the Trump investigations. But all that is just a shadow of the goblin that is rearranging the atmosphere, the poles, the oceans, and the landscape. The demon is us. Just consider the hoped-for recovery from Hurricane Harvey. Just now, Canada has an extra 400,000 barrels a day of heavy oil from the tar sands with no place to go. Pre-Harvey, it was processed in the refineries in Texas. Nobody else can do it. So the price of Canadian crude drops along with the Canadian dollar. We're told up to 500,000 cars and trucks were rendered useless by the hurricane floods. It took a lot of carbon to make all that steel and plastic. Just when the car industry was heading into another cycling slump, we'll get an additional burst of warming carbon just to replace the Harvey damaged vehicles. With what we know now, we shouldn't be making another single internal combustion engine. Let's spend more billions of dollars, hundreds of billions, on concrete and heavy equipment to replace the roads and freeways for those carbon burners. Let's spend another $500 billion on more building materials and shipping to replace all those homes. Of course, since we believe in freedom no matter what, people will put those roads and homes right back in the flood zones. That's partly because officially climate change does not exist. It cannot even be named in some departments in the new federal administration or in Texas. Planning to avoid the next disaster is prohibited by law. That's how deadly crazy things have become. Maybe because I work on the fringes of the media, I'm maddest at the media. We have some good work on the Russia investigation from a few big newspapers and a couple of cable news outlets, but even they fall into stories about puppy dogs, shallow coverage of big storms with lots and lots of flag waving. It's one big propaganda machine. Take this coverage by the American cable channel MSNBC. Finally, after a million hours of climate silence on the other networks, they stumble on a correspondent who wants to stand in the middle of a Texas flood and tell us how it is. Let's listen in.
Joining us live on the ground in Beaumont, the first camera to get there is my old friend Shihab Ratansi, Al Jazeera English reporter. His hotel is surrounded by water. He cannot get out of it, but he's got a shot. Shihab, what's the situation as you've seen it?
We're surrounded, as you said, as so many people are in Beaumont. We can take a look. I mean, we're at an island of calm, an oasis of dryness relative. But already this water is beginning to come up over here. This is I-10 behind us. Sections of this are now closed. Down there is Louisiana. That's the road we took to get here. The whole section moving to Louisiana is now shut, we understand. It's interesting listening to the mayor, though, just then, because we were listening to the mayor as well last night. If you were a resident in Beaumont last night and you are watching local television, you would have been reassured by what the mayor said, by what the weather forecaster said. This wasn't going to be as bad as this. I remember the mayor talking about all the investment they've done in drainage for roads and things like that. It's pretty clear something has gone wrong here with the forecasting and with the preparation. Clearly, the roads are now waterlogged. We understand 500 roads just in the southeast region are flooded. Actually, let me put this in difficult context. I know you were talking to someone in Port Arthur a moment ago. We're in what's called the Golden Triangle in the south. Now, you know, it's interesting. The reason why it's called the Golden Triangle is because this is the first place in the United States where they discovered large quantities of oil in 1901.
Right.
And that led to the Texas oil boom and the huge amounts of money come pouring into this region. It's pretty clear, though, that despite that, money has not been flowing into this region for the infrastructure, for the climate change effects that we knew were inevitable because of the oil and gas industry's activities on this coastline, even as those oil and gas industries were covering up what they knew about climate change in the 70s. I have to go on about this. Ali, you're an Al Jazeera guy. We get to the point on Al Jazeera.
Yep.
So that is very striking for us here. So much money has been made on this region,
and it hasn't gone into the infrastructure
to deal with the climate change that was inevitable because of the industry.
Hold that thought for 1 second, because on the screen we've got a live helicopter rescue. I believe I'm going to ask my control room. This is in Beaumont. Miguel Almaguer, I believe, is on that helicopter. They have lowered the basket to get somebody from the water. This is a Navy helicopter.
That's right. Just as the Al Jazeera reporter winds up to explain how Texans have been fleeced and left in danger by the oil industry, the camera gets whisked away to watch another helicopter rescue of some human. It's like calling squirrel to a dog. They can't resist. So after the unsuspecting gentleman is hauled up into the helicopter and into our living room screens, our MSNBC host manages to get back to his man on the ground. That reporter begins to wind up again about climate, big oil. Well, oh my gosh, they lose the connection, and they move on to another meaningless, surreal TV opportunity. Even the most left-leaning network just can't handle the truth. Sad. I'll be right back with Zoe Carpenter from The Nation.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Remember Hurricane Katrina revealed shocking poverty in New Orleans and ongoing pollution from petrochemical plants? Add millions more people and the world's largest chemical corridor, and you've got Houston, Port Arthur, and all that, after Hurricane Harvey. But as Wen Stevenson wrote in The Nation magazine on August 29th, Houston's human catastrophe started long before the storm. While the mainstream media grandstands with weather porn and pictures of dogs being rescued, let's go to Zoe Carpenter, associate editor for The Nation magazine. Zoe, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
It took a couple of days before we saw even brief photos of flooded refineries on ABC or Fox News, but the reporter never explains what that really means. What is the real story lurking there?
Well, the real story is that although this natural disaster was beyond anything that we've experienced before on the Gulf Coast in the last, you know, in recent history, there were lots of warnings and lots of things that could have been done to at least prepare better, especially when it comes to the chemical facilities, when it comes to the development in the area. And I think the, you know, the overarching story is that as we look ahead, these kinds of extreme weather events are going to challenge many more of our cities. And if we don't actually start looking forward instead of just rebuilding and assuming things are going to be the way that they were in the 1970s in terms of flooding and things like that, this is just going to keep happening.
Why does Wen Stephenson say the catastrophe in Houston started long before Harvey arrived?
Well, part of it is, you know, you have lots of factors here. So the catastrophe partly is related to development. There's been unchecked and relatively loosely regulated development in Houston into floodplains, which covers up prairie that used to absorb some of excessive rainfall. Of course, it wouldn't have absorbed all of 50 inches, but it would have absorbed some of that flooding. That prairie has now been covered up by concrete. You have building into low-lying areas that regularly flood. And then you have this pre-existing disaster of especially poor communities of color living near petrochemical plants, living in areas that are dangerous. And so that disaster has been around for decades.
And an estimated 80% of Houston residents don't have flood insurance. According to a new Harris poll, 78% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck if they have a job. What does the devastation of Hurricane Harvey mean for them?
Well, for them, it means a very uncertain future. You know, I think we're still in the stage where people are just starting to return to check out the damage of their homes in some cases. I think most of this week we've been focused on the immediate safety concerns. But for the people that don't have flood insurance, many of them may be unable to rebuild their homes, or if they're renters, you know, imagine if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you're renting an apartment and suddenly all of your furniture is ruined, the car that you depend on to get to work is no longer functional. These could be serious life-changing circumstances for people with no clear way for how to get out of them.
You know, when I heard that dozens of doctors volunteered to attend the Houston Convention Center to help evacuees, I thought this may be the first time some of those people have seen a doctor in years. They can't afford medical care. Talk to us about the health impacts of living in America's oil refinery.
Well, there are many, and they compound upon themselves. So there is evidence that rates of certain cancers are higher in communities near the petrochemical facilities. And again, those are largely communities that are lower income and of color. So there are serious environmental justice concerns. Now with the hurricane and the flooding, we have other more acute health issues related to infections from the water. There are many communities that don't have access to potable water right now. And then, of course, you have the larger problem of health insurance and lack of access to care more generally. So the Houston population, about a fifth of it is below the poverty line. Texas is very strict in terms of its requirements for eligibility for Medicaid. So you have these sort of chronic health issues that may have been exacerbated by the flooding. People who need access to dialysis, need access to medicines, who need to see a doctor, who, you know, may be pregnant and need to see their prenatal physician, now suddenly will face more barriers just to accessing basic care.
And when those refineries shut down, including America's largest, they don't just turn off a tap or turn out the lights. The Houston Chronicle was reporting that, quote, 2 million pounds of dangerous chemicals were released in Houston when they shut down between Monday and Wednesday. More has been released since then, and millions more will be released when the plants restart. Zoe, have you heard more about that?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that these refineries really aren't meant to be shut down and restarted the way that they were forced to. And so what happens is when you shut them down and restart them is you do have these excess emissions. And the companies file these reports, but they don't get sanctioned for these emergency emissions because it's an emergency situation. And so the impacts of that obviously fall upon the communities that live most closely to those refineries. And many did report unbearable chemical smells in the air, and many of them weren't able to evacuate. So not only have they been living near these petrochemical plants full time and experiencing sort of the daily cumulative effects of those chemicals, but now they're trapped near this sort of acute drastic emissions because of the storm. And I think one thing to keep in mind is that this isn't just accidental. The Texas politicians and the companies themselves have worked for many years to weaken or prevent regulation from these companies. So Arkema, which is the chemical plant where there have been a couple of explosions this week, they refused to release their chemical inventory so that we know exactly what chemicals might be being emitted from that plant. And they've also lobbied against a recent rule that was released under the Obama administration called the Chemical Disaster Rule, which would have put in place some more emergency measures, some better audits, and things of that nature. And recently, Scott Pruitt, the new EPA administrator, actually put a hold on that rule. So, like I said, this isn't just an accident.
And with up to 100,000 homes destroyed or just damaged in Houston, there have to be hundreds of thousands of people, I guess, displaced people. Do you think the government of Texas or the federal government will get them the support they need in time and continuing as they need it?
It's hard to imagine that every single person who has been displaced can be compensated properly for what they've lost. I think that's an unrealistic expectation. I think certainly there will be an effort to get emergency money to people and to have temporary housing. But I think the lessons from past disasters, even on a much smaller scale, such as the flooding in Baton Rouge last year, is that certain communities don't get all the help they need to fully recover. That means people living for years with tarps where their roofs used to be because they aren't able to rebuild their roofs. People living in FEMA trailers, and those are supposed to be temporary measures. But we see what's referred to as a new normal settle in, where measures that were supposed to be temporary become permanent as people don't have the support to fully regain what they lost.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Zoe Carpenter of The Nation magazine about some of the underreported news from Hurricane Harvey. Zoe, after watching tons of coverage, hardly anything on climate change is mentioned, much less the role of oil and petrochemical companies in helping cause climate disruption, denying global warming is happening, and making sure there's no regulations to plan for it. Your comments?
I think the conversation, when it does come up, is often framed in a really twisted manner, and people want to know whether we can say with certainty that this hurricane is due to climate change. But that's not really how climate change works. Climate change, it's not like it's some minion that's going to pull a string a weather disaster is going to occur. Basically, climate change means that the climatic conditions are changing in ways that lead to weather events being more extreme, for example. And so one of the ways in which climate change is very clearly linked to Hurricane Harvey is that as the temperature of the world increases, even just a bit, you have more moisture in the atmosphere, and that's just because of basic laws of physics. And then you also have more movement of that moisture. And so in the case of Houston, we saw that the Gulf of Mexico was much warmer than average temperatures. It was about 1 degree to 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer than historically average temperatures. And that meant that there was more moisture in the atmosphere, which led to so much rain being dumped. And another link is because of the way wind patterns and the way that the Gulf Stream has changed in relationship to climate change, the shifting wind patterns led or may have contributed to the hurricane sitting over the Houston area for so many hours and, you know, for days, in fact. And so those are some of the ways in which climate change is linked to Harvey. And it doesn't really matter whether we can say that climate change, quote unquote, caused this hurricane. What matters is that we know to expect more of these extreme weather events, and that it's really negligent, to say the least, not to prepare for that coming reality.
I feel like there are 1,000 stories in Hurricane Harvey. We'll be working on this for some time to come. Is it going to change the course of life and history in America, or is it just another blip along the road to a broken climate in a broken system? What do you think?
Well, it certainly will change the course of history for individual people and for individual families whose lives will take a dramatically different course because of this. Whether that gets written in the history books or not, you know, I can't say. I think that, unfortunately, the response from the right politically to this has been consistent with the past, that they're not willing yet to entertain a conversation about climate change. It may change the minds on the individual level, which I think is important. But, you know, part of the problem here is that even if people become more interested in preparing for extreme weather events, it's really hard to prepare for 50 inches of rain in a several-day period. There's only so much we can do. So, yes, we should prepare, but the bottom line is we actually have to do something to mitigate climate change, to stop it from proceeding along its current course, not just adapt to it.
Well, and I think, you know, Texas has its fair share of preppers, and I like to be prepared myself. And certainly if you have some water at home, that helps you when the water supply stops. But if you have to get out of your home, that doesn't help you so much. And I think The Nation ran another article talking about how everybody's an individualist and a libertarian until a catastrophe strikes, and then we're all supposed to be more socialist.
Of course, there's this sort of petty hypocrisy that you can see from some members of Congress who objected to using federal funding for Hurricane Sandy relief, and now they want federal funding for Houston. You know, that's obviously silly, but I don't know that it's worth spending too much time making fun of those people. I don't know how productive that is. But, you know, I think the larger point is that we celebrate the sort of local acts of communalism. So the Cajun Navy coming to help out people in Houston, and that's great. But we shouldn't have to rely on individual acts of heroism to respond to a disaster. This is what government is for preparing for and responding to wide-scale communal disasters. This is a community event that deserves a community response. And by community, I mean not only the individuals that make up a community, but their representatives and their government.
And also lost in the massive coverage by American and international networks is another series of floods in India, Pakistan, and East Asia. Over 1,200 people have died there. You know, why don't we hear in depth with 24-hour coverage about the floods that happen on another part of the world as opposed to what happens in America all the time?
It's troubling. I don't know exactly why. I mean, I think that's part of our inward-looking media culture. And certainly the disaster in India and in Bangladesh, and it's much faster than the scale of what's happened in Houston, and certainly deserves our attention. And I think that's what we can expect in future years, is that we're going to have these wide-scale disasters that happen in multiple areas of the country, multiple areas of the world.
Why is it that The Nation magazine often publishes unpleasant truths when the big news organizations won't?
Well, one reason is perhaps that we're not beholden to our advertisers. You know, we're an independent publication, and, you know, nobody's pulling the strings over there.
Good point. Same here. And as we wrap up, as a journalist, Zoe, what are your impressions of what this record-breaking extreme rainfall event really means as we head into the future?
Well, I think it means that reporters can cover climate in many different ways, and climate change reporting isn't only about extreme weather events, but when we're covering development in a coastal city, does that story include information about sea level rise? When we're talking about immigration and we're talking about all of these other things, how is climate part of the story? And I think that's sort of one of the news lessons to take away from this.
Well, for me, one of the challenges is not to get totally distracted by every disaster, because there's going to be more and more of them, but also to keep my eye on the science and what we really know about our situation and, of course, the solutions. What are we going to do as a society? Are we going to stop driving around in oil-based cars and trucks? What are we going to do? You know, that is a real challenge, not to get focused on the weather porn, I think.
Yeah, but at the same time, I do think it's worth, you know, keeping an eye on how individual communities are impacted immediately by the disaster. And I think that we've seen some really amazing local reporting coming out of the Houston Chronicle and other places that is really providing vital resources for the people who are in the area and need information. And that is certainly still a very important and worthwhile function of the news as well.
I agree. I'm still digging. I want to put some links in my show blog at ecoshock.org to some Texas environment groups who have been working on these issues for years and get them out there for our listeners as well. Zoe Carpenter has appeared on MSNBC, CNN, and other outlets. She regularly writes for The Nation magazine. She's the associate Washington editor there. Follow her on Twitter at Zoe S. Carpenter. And check out thenation.com. Zoe, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
And now for a Radio EcoShock roundup of all the news they didn't tell you this summer. As you've heard during the interviews, there were even large floods in eastern Nigeria, Africa, as well as Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh. At least 1,200 people died during floods in East Asia during August, and millions are homeless, without any food or hope of government aid. You can Google it, and BBC News in the UK are one of the few English-language networks to cover that. Regular listeners know that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a report on extreme weather events, which will increase as the world warms. I've done several programs on extreme rainfall events dating back to 2008. The atmosphere has warmed over 1 degree C, which allows it to hold 7% more water vapor. That means more rainfalls somewhere. It's simple physics. And then there are the fires. I was surrounded by them again this summer. We had more smoke alert days than clear days. It was very hot here, well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit or 35 degrees C, day after day. There's been no rain here for almost 2 months. This isn't summer as I ever knew it. In Canada, British Columbia declared its second ever state of emergency as hundreds of forest fires erupted. It's cost about $750 million to fight them. Tens of thousands of people were evacuated, including from cities. Gigantic valleys burned. The smoke drifted over 1,000 miles to the east. Aboriginal people have been evacuated from northern Manitoba and Saskatchewan provinces as more fires burned there. Crops withered in the key grain-growing parts of southern Saskatchewan. There were major fires in California, Oregon, and Washington as this broadcast goes to air. The West is burning again. That's another predicted outcome of climate change, but even the best scientists did not expect it this early. Let me just skim through some of the headlines that would have been world affairs before these turbulent times. I'll read through them, and you can follow up what interests you through the links posted in my weekly show blog. That appears every Wednesday by 6 p.m. Pacific time at ecoshock.org. In North America, a drought in the Western Plains threatens some of the wheat crop. Sacramento was hit by a record-breaking heat wave. People who attended the Burning Man Festival this year in Nevada suffered through 100-degree Fahrenheit heat, not seen there at this time of year since the 1940s. And they got a massive sandstorm that filled every tent, RV, and nose. It was apocalypse now for those folks at $1,000 a ticket. In July, in nearby Death Valley, California, they set a new global record for the hottest single month ever since official records began in 1911. The East Coast hardly saw a beach day for the month of July. It was strange. New Englanders were on the cool side of the great bending jet stream that's been changed since the Arctic sea ice melted. A heat wave swept over the Arctic in Canada with severe fires in the Northwest Territories. It was the same in Siberia and Russia. Heat, fires, and smoke. We can only imagine the amount of carbon released there, especially when the peat catches fire. And as I've told you, there were fires on Greenland. That's not unheard of, but it's pretty strange to get ones that big. Moving on to Europe. In early August, the Telegraph reported the European heat wave, which killed five, with temperatures soaring above 40 degrees C. In France, wildfires forced mass evacuations in late July, especially along the Mediterranean. As you no doubt heard, there was a sad incident where over 60 members of a Portuguese village were killed trying to flee a fire. The fires in Portugal were declared a public calamity. The great city of Rome faced an unusual water shortage with rationing. Even the Vatican shut off its fountains. Extreme heat decimated crops in Central and Southeast Europe, exposing the riverbeds not seen for centuries in places. Overall in Europe, it was called the Lucifer heat wave, which led to a higher death rate and crop damage. Summer skiing at one Italian glacier was shut down for the first time in 90 years, just another sign of the times. Turkey experienced strange and severe storms. Government workers in Iraq were laid off due to blistering heat. Birds were reported falling dead from the sky when temperatures in Kuwait went over 50 degrees C or 122 degrees Fahrenheit. An eastern province of Nigeria was recently hit by super floods, with countless people losing their homes, cattle, and all their belongings. I've already reported on the super monsoon floods that hit northern and eastern India, leaving hundreds of thousands homeless. In late July, there was another extreme rainfall event and flash flooding in the Kingdom of Bhutan. Torrential rains crippled Karachi, Pakistan on August 31st. The Indian financial capital of Mumbai, formerly Bombay, was shut down by heavy rains and flooding on September 1st. India got 10 times the usual amount of rain within a 10-day time period. Bangladesh was also hit by the super rains. More crisis there. Not much on your television screens. Meanwhile, new science on climate change concludes parts of Southeast Asia will be, quote, unlivable by 2100. Scientists also say living in Pakistan will be difficult by the year 2100 due to long-lasting extreme heat waves. During all this, fossil fuel use is rising, not falling. Yes, greenhouse gas emissions have fallen in America, but the U.S. is still a gigantic source of climate-damaging gases. The rest of the world is trying to catch up and live as the U.S. does, and they're more than filling the American decline. Scientists are reluctantly admitting that the world is almost certain, that's their words, to warm by 2 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. Believe me, that is a disaster far greater than you or I have ever known. One British investment firm, Schroders, which controls assets worth $542 billion, is far more pessimistic. They think 7 to 8 degrees C of warming is possible. Experts are predicting more humid heat waves, the most dangerous kind for mammals. Another report predicts heat waves up to 55 degrees C or 131 degrees Fahrenheit. That's from the European Joint Commission, and I hope to have the lead author of that report on Radio EcoShock perhaps next week. By the way, did I mention, new science shows global ocean circulation is beginning to collapse due to a warming planet. All life depends on that circulation. And last year, 2016, was once again the hottest year ever recorded, according to the State of the Climate in 2016 report. That's led by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, and plus scientists from 60 nations. 2016, hottest ever, once again. And I bet you 2017 sets a new record. Outside my home, it's now too smoky to go outside and breathe. One valley to the west, a new fire erupted last night in the Okanagan, near Peachland. In the extreme heat and high winds, it went from 40 hectares to over 1,000 hectares, about 2,500 acres, overnight. In this area, which was already housing evacuees from fires further north, a fresh round of evacuation has already begun. There has been no rain there for a couple of months. The grass, shrubs, and trees are as dry as can be, literally tinder. The sun, shadowed by fire clouds, is blazing red. The hills and the ground are tinted with the colors of sunset at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Something deep inside me, something from our animal roots, something from a million years ago tells me how wrong all this is, how dangerous these times are becoming. There is no end to apocalyptic headlines. While recording this short feature, the largest fire in Los Angeles history popped up. As of September 2nd, the La Tuna Fire grew to over 5,000 acres, according to the LA Fire Department. Homes in Burbank and Glendale were evacuated. Los Angeles has fires from time to time. I've lived there, I know. But keep in mind, this is again a record, the largest ever. It was 91 degrees in L.A., but with the humidity, it felt like 104 degrees or 40 degrees C. To the north, San Francisco broke an all-time record high for September 1st. Broke isn't the right word. Jason Salmonow at the Capital Weather Gang says the record was smashed. San Francisco on the sea is known to be cool even in summer. They were not ready for the hottest day ever since records began. It was an astonishing 106 degrees Fahrenheit or 41 degrees C. The previous high was 3 degrees lower than that, and that was in the year 2000. The average high for this time of year in San Francisco, Jason tells us, is around 70 degrees Fahrenheit or 21 degrees C. So this September 1st was more than 30 degrees above normal. That's got to tell you something. Is all this getting through? We are already in a global climate emergency. That is the real news. Anything else is a distraction. This is the time to fight for our survival and to turn back the tide of extinction. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock as we ride through these turbulent times together.
Tired of cheerleaders and phony media issues? We treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are.
Looking for the awful truth? Dig in with Alex Smith.
Actually, you're never going to get millions of people on the streets to campaign against climate change because they'll be campaigning against their own way of life.
Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No fear, Deep Green Radio EcoShock. Join us. I've left a small personal story of climate change for the end of this program. It's not a big thrill like the footage from Hurricane Harvey or the fires in France. It's small, but I think there is a point. My family traveled to a nearby mountain lake this summer, as we do every year. We camp out without any electricity except for our small solar panel. One day as we headed out to get more supplies, we saw a massive cloud erupting to the south, tinged with red. We were seeing the start of a forest fire that caused more hundreds to evacuate their homes, this time near Kelowna in British Columbia. As we attempted to get back to the lake, a big windstorm blew through, taking down power lines along the road. And that road was closed by the police for a few hours while the power lines were removed from the pavement. No big problem. We waited and then got back in. At the end of our week in paradise, we drove through another forest road to get home, except there was a fire there. Traffic was only allowed through, 30 cars at a time, escorted by the police. We saw Canadian Army men helping, as firefighters filled big vats of water for the helicopters to pick up. The roadside was black, trees all burned. After a couple of hours, we got through. Getting home, the air was thick with smoke. It was hot and unhealthy to be outside. But we know how to live with that. Our home is very tight, with two HEPA air cleaners that can take out the tiny particles before we breathe them in. Unfortunately, I'm going to recommend that for everyone in the West and everyone where a fire can burn. You should have a HEPA air cleaner. It's a special type of air cleaner. I work inside when that happens on the radio program, while automated sprinklers keep my garden alive. Everything survives out there. But the tomatoes stopped flowering. We will have no fall tomatoes this year. It's a peculiarity that even the professional growers noticed when smoke fills the air. The point is, as climate change gets worse and worse, humans will adapt. And that is the problem. We are so very adaptable. We keep on living the way we do, driving around. I mean, nothing should stop our holidays. We have to get to work. Even as hurricanes flood out homes down the road, or fires burn out neighboring cities. Nobody really considers questions like, should we stop driving carbon-based cars? Should we stop buying food or flowers flown in from other countries? Should we really change? I used to think that climate-driven disasters would finally bring the public to their senses. We would take action on a grand scale to save nature and ourselves. But now, looking at my own life, I'm not so sure. Maybe our ability to adapt is what will keep this fossil parade marching right off the cliff. Maybe adapting is the worst policy. I am taking steps to change. A listener and longtime friend just donated an electric bike. I'm so grateful. Now I can go around my village and buy groceries and all that without using fossil fuels. We burn wood in the winter, which saves all kinds of carbon. Trees capture carbon from the atmosphere, so burning it adds nothing. I know we can't all burn wood, especially in cities, or the forests would be doomed. But what I'm talking about is there are options that each of us can take if you look around. My geothermal greenhouse is half built now. The pipes are in the ground, and I finished the concrete block foundation. I hope there is some room to grow food year-round without using fossil fuels. It may even cool the plants during extra hot summers. I'll report more when that is operational. We capture hundreds of gallons of rainwater for the garden from our roof. Use those eavesdrops. We buy used clothing and goods when we can. Don't make new carbon that way. There are a lot of small steps each of us can take. And we not only reduce our carbon footprint, but we lead our neighbors into a more climate-friendly lifestyle as well. Preventing a climate disaster, it's a direction that each of us can take. Please consider what you can do, even in small ways. It could add up, pushing us towards the big change we all need so much. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and please try to catch the show, every show, this season.